Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
What do chickadees, polar bears, kudzu, and Alaska have in common? On this Outdoor Explorer, I, your host Paul Twardock, am joined by author Mary Beth Holloman, artist Kristen Link, and writer Brad Micklejohn to discuss their latest projects, including Mary Beth's novel Bloom Again and Brad's writing about the gray-headed chickadee. On the first half of the show, Mary Beth and Kristen discuss how art and literature, specifically Mary Beth's novel Bloom Again and Kristen's artwork featuring a polar bear and kudzu, that is, the book's cover, can help communicate science. On the second half, Brad talks about his article on the gray-headed chickadee, a rare bird in Alaska's Arctic. He is one of the last people to see the bird in Alaska. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. I have Mary Beth Holloman, author of Bloom Again, with me in the studio, and Kristen Link on Zoom, who illustrated the cover of the book. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here.
So, Mary Beth, why don't we start... Kristen's in, calling in from McCarthy, in frigid McCarthy. So, Mary Beth, why don't we start with you? Just go ahead and outline the book for us.
Sure. Bloom Again is a novel, my first novel, and it has two main characters. Elise is an artist in Anchorage, Alaska, and Astrid is a paleobotanist in North Carolina. And they both have these seemingly fulfilling lives, which are shaken up by a series of environmental and other catastrophes. And through a series of events, they come to remember their shared past and find a way forward together.
And what was your inspiration? What was the genesis of the book?
Well, there were several different things that happened over many years to make me decide to write a novel, because I've written, as you know, nonfiction and poetry, never written fiction before, but I had written about climate change essays, poetry for a while, and I was at a conference at Association for the Study of Literature and the Environment, a panel of writers, and one of them was Anne Pancake, who had written this incredible novel about mountaintop coal mining in West Virginia. It's a gorgeous novel. And she had, it's called, the title is Strange as This Weather Has Been. And she had done what, like, Barbara Kingsolver did in Prodigal Summer, where you have this incredible story with these characters and a plot, and you're able to bring in big scary things like mountaintop coal removal or climate change or, you know, into that story and reach people in a different way. And so I talked to Anne afterwards and I thought, oh, maybe I should try that. So I did.
And polar bears, are a big part of it. And there's a quote at the beginning of the book about something about touching noses with a polar bear.
That's who the book is dedicated to.
Right. Is that the dedication? Is that an actual event?
Yes, it is an actual event. Years and years ago, when you could go to Kaktovik and see the polar bears on the whalebone pile in the fall, we went up there, and this was when you could take an old school bus out to the bone pile and sit and watch the bears. And we were watching them, and this big male came over towards the bus and reared up, put his front paws up on the side of the bus, looked in the window where I was sitting with my mouth wide open, and I realized that I had my window down.
Whoops.
It was quite a moment, and I didn't really feel fear. I think the bus driver honked the horn or something and made him run off, but yeah, we almost touched noses, for real. It was, you know, you never forget those moments.
Oh, no, I would never forget it at all.
Yeah.
And Kristen, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into art and maybe your connection with this book.
Yeah. So I am an artist and science illustrator. I live in McCarthy, a little cabin out here. And I've always loved art and science. People told me I should combine them, but I didn't know what that looked like. But eventually, after kind of like finishing my college degree, I looked up science illustration and found out that you could do art about natural history, not just like medical illustration. So I pursued that as a certificate program and have been working as a science illustrator up here, making art about nature and kind of telling stories about the natural world. And then Mary Beth got in touch with me last winter in need of some illustrations for the cover of this book. So she said, we need... like kudzu and polar bear illustration. So I got to work with her on that.
We'll come back to that. But I want to follow up. So you live in McCarthy. How does that work? I'm really interested in that sort of career, sort of passion thing about being in McCarthy and making that work as an artist. And how do you find work? How does it all come together for you?
One cool thing about being an artist and illustrator is that you can do a lot of work remotely. So like for this book, drawing kudzu, which is something I couldn't see in person, or polar bears, but you can do image research and kind of combine things and imagine it in your head, make that work. So you can do illustration from anywhere, which is amazing. But then I also do a lot of work that's inspired by place. So I've been lucky and worked to create a lot of kind of like work for myself that's based out here. So I do an illustrated column for our local newspaper about what's going on in the natural world. I'm doing a Otna language calendar with the Copper River Native Association right now. So it's been fun to tie my illustration work to the local landscape organizations out here.
And so you're illustrating art, you're illustrating place and sometimes language and a lot of things through art. That's awesome. So kudzu, do I have that right?
Kudzu. Yeah.
So it plays a part in this book. So tell us, Alaskans, what it is. It's very Korean, I know that.
So one of the things that's going on in the book is the characters aren't just humans, polar bears. A specific polar bear is a character. Kudzu is a character, too.
Yes.
Really is an impactful plant for both of them. But I grew up in North Carolina, and so I'm very familiar with it. This is a plant that it's an invasive species. It came from Asia. It was intentionally introduced at the Centennial Exhibit in Philadelphia in the U.S. As an ornamental plant. And then the U.S. Department of Agriculture said it would be a good plant to control erosion and so gave it away for free to all these farmers all over the East, especially the Southeast. And it grows a foot a day, and it's a big, heavy vine. And it has literally, you can, you know, Google search, you'll see photos of it just covers and kills trees, covers buildings. It's collapsed buildings. It's an amazing plant. And we should figure out how to use it because it's very powerful.
Yeah. And is it a metaphor of sorts?
It's a metaphor for, you know, well, I wanted us to think about, you know, invasive species is a big problem, but usually we introduce them. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to complicate that. You know, like I feel that we need to learn how to live alongside everything that's going on, everyone that's living where we live. So I really brought it in as sort of a metaphor for sort of unintentional growth. Like, we think we have this career path, or we think we have this life path, and then stuff happens and we have to readjust.
I like this. You have a line in there: any action we take is just in cooperation with or resistance to whatever is already happening.
Yeah.
So that's what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Like, it's already happening. Basic species are happening. So how do we deal with that?
Yes.
In a way.
How do we respond?
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. So we have polar bears. We have these characters. We have polar bears and kudzu. So, Kristen, I want to come back to you and describe the cover for us of the book and how you came up with that, the cover. It's a beautiful piece of art.
Yeah, it looks, I'm really happy with how it turned out. Mary Beth contacted me. I think she had a very strong vision of kind of what she wanted to see with the kudzu and the polar bear on the cover, especially with, I wasn't super familiar with kudzu, but the way she described it as something that like really takes over. I want to feel of it as a vine and how it keeps growing and has all these tendrils. So that was really fun to draw. And then we played around a little bit with the polar bear's like front or back of the head, and I ended up illustrating both. They both ended up on like the front and the back cover, which is kind of fun. The polar bear's face is on the back cover, but you just see the back of its ears kind of looking off into the distance on the front cover, which is kind of a nice sense of space and kind of looking into the future.
Ah, so let's now, I want to talk a bit about that part when you, Kristen, when you think about communicating through art. Can you talk about that a bit? Like when you think about, let's say, obviously, in this, as an example, in this novel, you're trying to have a cover that represents the novel. So talk about your thinking and your thought process with that when you're trying to communicate. You just said something about the future.
Yeah, I think themes that come up in the novel are that art can communicate emotionally some things that science and other forms of communication can't, and having kind of like the different modes of viewing something, reading something, getting information can help us think about it in different ways, and it all kind of helps to build a picture. So I really appreciate in art not having a exact photographic example of something. Even as a science illustrator, I think all my artwork still feels like it's made by a human, and that's really important to me. There's this little bit of nuance or interpretation that's there, and I think that can help, one, clarify something to make it a little bit simpler, just to distill things down to like what you want to communicate and show, but also to show that there's a bit of mystery or unknown there as well sometimes.
Yeah.
So art can help do all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Beth, how about you? Like when you're talking about communicating art and science, what are your thoughts about that? Is it effective? Is it like that? Yeah.
I think it's really important. And like Kristen, I've always been drawn to both art and science. And so, I could have become a botanist like Astrid. I almost did. But instead, I chose writing. And I feel really strongly that the two, art and science, can work together so well. And that's something that the two characters in the novel come to realize. And I see it more and more. I think it's happening more and more. But I was thinking of, and I'm not sure who said it, but it's something like science without art is like solutions without heart, or something like that.
Yeah.
But, the emotional quality that art brings in that speaks so to our living experience with all that science finds out. It's
right.
Really important.
And does art, like art, can it trip itself up? Like, that's what I'm saying. Does art and novel, like you wrote this novel, you illustrated this novel, were you worried about having the wrong message get out or being interpreted in ways, because people interpret art however they want to interpret it? So I guess my question is was that ever come to your mind as you're writing this or thinking about illustrating it, that people might come up with a wrong impression?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I'm always terrified of that in anything I write. It's tricky because people do bring their own selves to everything they read and see, and But that's part of the beauty of it, too. So far, the feedback I've gotten, it has not been misunderstood, which pleases me. But maybe I just haven't heard from those people. Who knows? But I think that when I think about, like, Elise's painting, so for the cover, because Elise is a painter and I describe a lot of her paintings, I didn't want the cover to look anything like her paintings. So when Kristen said I had a strong vision, that was one of them. I didn't want people to think they were looking at one of her. So anyhow, when I was writing the scenes of her doing her paintings and the way they came to me, I thought, wow, you know, it's just so interesting how you can pull science into art to communicate. And it might be misinterpreted, but that's the risk that you take. And it's really important that we do choose to leap, especially right now.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. We're talking about the novel Bloom Again with Mary Beth Holloman, the author, and Kristen Link, who illustrated the cover. Do you have a reading for us involves a mammoth tusk or something like that?
Yeah. So this is Elise. She's on an artist residency in the Arctic, and she comes upon some mammoth tusks in the tundra. Elise has never seen mammoth remains outside of a museum, has never seen them in the place where the animal lived and died. She touches the tusk, the smoothness surprising her. But it's the colors that are most astonishing, as if every color that has ever existed is in that fossilized curl. Browns open to reds, blend to purples, fade to blues. Hints of greens reveal yellows. They swirl together and apart in a patterned rhythm like some forgotten language. How many thousands of years has this lain here, undisturbed except by wind and snow and the talons of the owl? Burnished ivory spiring from vast tundra, speaking of the tenuous hold of existence.
Hmm. So that was Elise. She's the artist.
Yeah.
And then Astrid is the scientist.
Yes.
As they evolve in the story, do they, what's that tension between them? You know, the artist and their friend, childhood friends. I've put a little bit away here, but not much, I don't think. Let's take Astrid. How does art influence her?
Well, in the beginning, not at all.
Right, exactly. Really,
she is a scientist and she does basic research, which is simply doing research for, just to learn, like not any kind of applied, not any kind of trying to, i.e. help the world, but just to learn. She's just studying plant fossils to learn about the plant. And so she has no use for all these other things, even though she does have a friend who's an artist that she, you know, cares deeply about, but she doesn't understand her art and she doesn't really even try to, except then she does. There's a scene where she does, where it finally hits her what her friend Charlotte is doing with her artwork. And that's the first little crack of the window for Astrid.
Yeah. Giving her maybe hope, maybe a little bit, or like leading to that, cracking that window a little bit.
To just opening her to a broader range of awareness, which allows her then to realize more about what's going on and how she might participate.
And does the same thing happen with Elise? Or something similar, parallel with Elise in art? Or Elise in science.
Elise in science. Yeah. So Elise reads about the fate of polar bears, and then she, because of that, because she can't stand the thought that they might disappear, it doesn't seem like it's not, doesn't register for her. She's an artist, so she really sees the world that way in an imaginative sense. But that turns her towards reading and reading and reading about them, and she ends up reading all these scientific articles about them. And so that's her entryway into science and learning more about what's going on or what scientists know at this point in time about what's going on with polar bears. Yeah.
And she has a connection with a polar bear.
She does, with a polar bear named Binky.
Yeah, Binky, some of us might remember Binky.
Yes.
Right, yeah, in the Anchorage Zoo. And so that leads us to sort of this next thing, because it's not great news for polar bears.
No.
Right? And so that's the next sort of phase of what I like to talk about is going with, we have a lot of discouraging news about whether it's climate change or mass extinctions. I was just reading about birds today. The second half of the show, we have Brad Mickeljohn talking about a chickadee that has apparently disappeared from the North Slope. And so where do these characters find hope? Let's talk about that, like how we resolve and keep moving forward and not just sink into despair.
Well, I'll focus on Elise here because she is more aware to begin with, more receptive to the bad news, to getting the bad news. And she's overwhelmed at first. And as we all have been and are at times. But when you're overwhelmed, you're paralyzed, you're stuck. And so the point is to pick something that you can do. For Elise, she's a painter. She can use her art. And just take, I think of the Margaret Murray quote, something her father told her when she was working on conservation in Alaska. And he said, there's always enough light to see the next step. I think, okay, the next step. If we look at everything all at once, it's terrifying. But if we look at what can I do right now with the information that I have right now, what can I do, take the next step, then it's calming. You feel a sense of power. You feel a sense of agency. And that's my best idea for how to deal.
Yeah. Kristen, you want to talk about that, and particularly when it comes to art and how art can give us possibilities maybe of some sort?
An important thing that art does for me is kind of also create a place to process and hold sadness, kind of like share that with people so that we can say, like, I know this is changing and it's heartbreaking, but at least we can kind of hold that together. And then that, for me, has been a space. I've done a lot of work about glaciers melting, and I'm doing that work has opened up the what's next, what do we see next, and kind of led me in a like very tangible way to doing artwork about what's growing on the edges of glaciers, which is its own beautiful story. So I think that the place for art to kind of hold that sadness is also really important, and share it with other people as a way to just process it and move on into the next thing as well.
And I imagine art also has a way of, it might be ironically, capturing change. And change can be beautiful, even that sometimes we don't really like, right?
Yeah, I think it's hard. And I think it's hard for us to see the things we love change. And I think that's a theme that also comes up in the book that's explored really nicely, is being able to bear witness to that change and how we capture it in different ways. So definitely art has an important role with that. And it's something that's hard to explain in other mediums that tend to be more static. So having that just different ways of showing things can help show change in the dynamic world.
And write a novel, write in fiction. This is sort of new for you, Mary Beth. Mm-hmm. And does that apply there too, that you can describe and do things in fiction that you might not be able to do in a nonfiction piece?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I've always written about nature and environmental issues. You know, my first book, The Heart of the Sound, the central event was the oil spill in Prince William Sound. So the things that I write about are often very heartbreaking and difficult. But if I play in the form, as I'm sure Kristen does with art, you know, I imagine, it's that's the delight. And so it was delightful to work in fiction, to learn how to, you know, to write fiction and create characters and develop characters and watch them take over the story, which was really cool.
Yeah, and did that help you deal with your sort of
it did because
despair or whatever, what feelings you have with the changing environment?
Yeah, it did because now this book's out in the world, and I think there are people reading it, and it's affecting them. And I know that most of the time, as writers, it's very lonely, and we don't really know what kind of impact we're having unless, you know, we really make it big. But every now and then you find out. And can I tell a quick story? Do I have enough time?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So many, many years ago, I wrote an essay for Orion magazine on the restoration efforts after the oil spill in Prince William Sound. This was pre-digital. Okay. And so the magazine came out. Months later, there was a letter to the editor of Orion from a guy who lives in Durham, North Carolina, near where I used to live. And he said, you know, I saw another article about the oil spill. I was like, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to read any more about it. But then he read it and he thought, oh, that applies to what I'm trying to do to save the Eno River near where I live. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see that. It was like, so cool. Now, flash forward to like a few weeks ago, I get an email from this guy. And he had moved to Western North Carolina. And now he's writing a book on the effects of Hurricane Helene on Western North Carolina, where I grew up. The hurricane that smashed Asheville and many parts of it. And he's just incredible naturalist. And he's, you know, and now we're like back in touch. And it's just so interesting to know how he was asking for a copy of that essay. I was like, well, ask Orion. It's not digital. But it, that impact that you have on other people, that ripple effect, like with your show, and it reaches other people and you have a ripple effect. And so that's, that feels good to me, you know, to feel like I know it's having a positive impact, even though I may not ever hear about it. I got to hear about this one guy, but mostly you don't know.
Yeah.
You just have to have faith.
Right. Now, both of you were involved in the residence, arts and residency program, and that's I think a government, federal government program. Want to talk about maybe, Kristen, what you did with that program?
I've gotten to do a number of different artist residencies with the federal government and with different organizations. Some recent ones, I think Mary Beth and I both got to do the Voices of the Wilderness residency, which is with different federal agencies that have wilderness areas, and you get to go out and work with park rangers and be out on the landscape. So I did mine in Eastern Prince William Sound. It was really cool. And kind of adds another layer to be able to be with people who know that landscape so well, have worked there for such a long time, and are doing work like taking care of it, teaching other people about it, and fixing the trails and things like that.
And did you I think you create art out of that also? Is that part of the deal?
Yeah, part of the deal is to create artwork. So I do a lot of field sketching, which I did while I was there. And then also create a series of artwork for their visitor center, just kind of like different things that I saw and were important to me during that trip. And one cool thing is that I think like that experience is going to come back into a project I'm working on this next year. So things kind of stay up in your brain, and a lot of times artist residencies impact you for years to come. So I'll do some work about Prince William Sound again this coming year, and I'm excited to kind of revisit my time there.
Oh, thanks.
That experience.
And Mary Beth, you've done a bunch of these things, that how they influenced even this book and your work going ahead.
Yeah. Well, in the book, Elise goes on an artist residency, which is powerful for her. And it's a wilderness kind of residency too. But the ones that I've done here, the same program that brought Kristen to Eastern Prince William Sound, it was the Voices of the Wilderness program, which was through the Forest Service, but doesn't exist anymore. And I got to go to Southeast Alaska with the Wilderness Rangers kayaking for 10 days. I mean, it was awesome. And then I did one also in the eastern side of the Sound, too, with them. And then I did one in Denali. They used to have an artist-in-residence program where you stay in the Murray cabin.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to spend time with a wolf biologist, mm-hmm. going out with him. I got to spend time with a paleontologist who showed me dinosaur tracks and told me the story of how they found. I mean, to be able to spend time with scientists in the field like that, for an artist or a writer, it's something else.
And that has to give you some, I don't know, hope or whatever the word is, some feeling of like, oh, there's still things to do out there, and to stay active and continue your activism, correct?
Yes, and to meet other people who also have that passion for the land and wildlife and for protecting these places and sharing what they learn, telling their stories, yeah.
And another project? Any other projects on
for
the radar?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, there's a book coming out in March that I'm one of three editors of. It's the Alaska Literary Field Guide, and Kristen is one of 20 Alaskan artists that are also in that book. And we've selected, I think, 93 beings in Alaska, plant, animal, otherwise. And for each one, say, brown bear. For brown bear, we have an Alaska artist who's done an image for us. We have a poet, an Alaska poet who's written a poem. And then we have a narrative that's kind of like a field guide, but a little more evocative.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's, again, science and art. And, you know, speaking for the natural world. It's going to be a gorgeous book.
I look forward to seeing it. You've been listening to Outdoor Explorer. I've had Mary Beth Holloman with her novel Plumagem and Kristen Link, who helped illustrate it, or did illustrate it. We'll have a link to the book and to Kristen's work on the Outdoor Explorer website. We're going to take a short break and be back with Brad Micklejohn. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. I have Brad Micklejohn with me on Zoom. Welcome back to the show, Brad.
Nice to be back, Paul. Good to see you.
So today we're talking about the gray-headed chickadee. You have an article that's come out in Birder Magazine that has gotten quite the response. Why don't you tell us a bit about your story with this bird?
Thanks, Paul. In June of 2016, Roman Dial and I were traversing from the Noatak River over to the Kobuk. This is up in northwest Alaska in the Brooks Range. And the purpose of the trip was not to look for gray-headed chickadees, but we did happen to come across a pair of gray-headed chickadees on the Tatooksook River. And that's one of the last times these birds have been seen in North America. They used to be relatively common throughout the 1900s, first reported in Alaska in 1864. And fairly common through until the late 1990s. And then they suddenly blinked out right around the time that Roman and I saw the last sighting of these birds is in 2017. And gray-headed chickadees are one of their 12 other species of chickadees and related tits in that family. And gray-headed chickadees are one of three species of chickadee in Alaska. The other two that are quite common are boreal chickadee and gray-headed chickadee. And you know, you may not be into birds, but if you know birds at all, you've probably seen chickadees. They're just about as common as robins or eagles or ducks. So they're one of the more common birds coming to your feeder. And these gray-headed chickadees are they occur across Eurasia through Siberia through Norway and Finland. So they're still relatively common in other parts of the world, and they were relatively common here in Alaska and northwestern Canada. But they seem to have completely vanished, and despite a lot of effort in finding them, they haven't been seen since 2017. And it's not exactly clear what's going on with these birds. They seem to be kind of a harbinger of some of the impacts of climate change. You might call them the chickadee in the oil mine, if you will.
You saw this bird, heard this bird. Where were you at?
We were on the Tatooksook River, which is a tributary of the Salmon River that flows into the Kobuk. And the gray-headed chickadee used to be found in the boreal regions of northwest Alaska, kind of on the frontier of the Arctic tundra. In places on the North Slope, they occupy some of the few stands of poplar trees. In places like the Canning River and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, on the Colleen, which is down in the southeast corner of the Arctic Refuge. They used to be found on the Kelly River, the Woolock River, relatively easy to find all through the 1900s and into the early 2000s. And they look a lot like, you know, other chickadees, like a black-capped chickadee or a boreal chickadee. These guys are just slightly bigger than a boreal chickadee. They have gray heads and a big white cheek patch. And, you know, as is typical with chickadees, they're pretty approachable. They're pretty noisy and friendly. They're an easy bird to see if they're around. They respond to birders, playing tapes to attract them in. And if they're around, you generally are going to see them. Part of the reason this species, gray-headed chickadee, is it's one of the least studied birds in North America, and that's because of the remoteness of their habitat. You've got to get into these places, you either have to mount an expedition by boat or by plane, and spend a lot of time enduring bugs and bears and the challenges of wilderness travel. So even though they've been known since the 1860s, there's not a lot known about them. The first nest of gray-headed chickadees was found in the 1990s by my neighbor Bob Dittrich. He used to run a company called Wilderness Birding Adventures.
That's amazing. Not till 1990s, finding a nest. And so they're on both north and south of the Brooks Range. Do I have that right?
Yeah. The last nesting pairs were found over on the Marsh Fork of the Canning River in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And that was a reliable spot for decades. That's where Wilderness Birding Adventures would lead rafting trips of birders looking to see this particular species. And it was kind of a money bird for Bob Dittrich and his successor, Aaron Lang. They were pretty reliably found there and over at the Kelly River. It's a tributary of the Noatak. And so they, the first place that Bob found them nesting was in these relatively small cottonwood trees on the Marsh Fork. And the trees, they're maybe 8 inches in diameter. They're not very big, but they're just big enough to support a cavity. The birds probably aren't making those cavities themselves, probably made by some sort of a woodpecker or just decay of a limb falling off. They were also found using swallow nests on the Canning River as well. And so the last time they were seen was in 2017 on the Marsh Fork of the Canning. And since then, despite a lot of effort, they haven't been found. Between 2010 and 2017, there was something like 800 hours of survey time. This is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Alaska Department of Fish and Game out looking for these birds. And over 800 hours, they found 3 birds in total. And one of those birds was the last one ever seen. So it's not really clear what's happened to these birds. And it looks like it's kind of the part of a pattern of the decline of other birds and insects in the Brooks Range. We're seeing a lot of kind of climate chaos happening in the form of like resting rivers, as documented by Roman Dial, and movement of vegetation, kind of an advance of tree line. We're seeing other species become a lot less common. There are a number of birders who are familiar with the Brooks Range, and almost everybody comments on how much quieter it is in the springtime during the typical breeding season. There's just a lot fewer birds up there. So it looks like gray-headed chickadee may be a victim of kind of the climate chaos. And, some of the things that may be at play include the increasing variability of winter weather. We're getting these intense warm-ups during the middle of the winter where we're getting rain on snow, which plays havoc on, everything from dall sheep to caribou to maybe a little bird like a gray-headed chickadee. I mean, these birds are only about an ounce and a half. They're just a little ping pong ball of fluff. And, they can fluff up and stay warm in cold temperatures, but you add a warm up to 40 degrees in rain, and that's just really brutal on a small bird. Gray-headed chickadees also cache a lot of food, like fat that they scrounge off of moose carcasses that they cache. And if you get a winter warm-up, it could render some of those food sources inaccessible.
Yeah, we'll get more into that in a little bit with the climate change. There a little bit more about the bird itself. And it's sort of related to their fluffing up. How do they survive the winters? They're up in a pretty harsh environment. They don't migrate, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Basically, all the members of the chickadees family don't migrate. So one of the attributes of gray-headed chickadees is they have little family groups, and they kind of hunker down together and fluff up and kind of keep each other warm. And they're pretty active birds. They don't really go into any kind of a state of hibernation. So, and they're one of the few birds that stays up north all year round. There aren't many others. You've got species like red poles, ravens, surprisingly dippers remain on the north slope. It seems like these gray-headed chickadees would nest on the north slope and then move south of the Brooks Range, south onto the south slope of the Brooks Range in the wintertime. And there is a trapper, a relatively famous trapper by the name of Heimel Korth, who has trapped over on the Colleen River for about 40 years. And Heimel would regularly see these birds, the gray-headed chickadees, coming into his hanging moose carcasses and caribou carcasses, and they pick the fat off of the carcasses and cache that fat and live off that fat in the course of the winter. And talking to Heimo, he hasn't seen these birds in the last 10 years, even though he saw them regularly for the 30 years before that. So it's an open question as to whether they're still out there. It's a huge expanse of country. It's entirely possible that they're in some place that hasn't been searched. But all the reliable places where they were previously seen throughout the 1900s and into the early 2000s, nobody can find them. And I've been looking for these birds personally for close to 40 years. I've seen them three times in three different places. And over the since 2017, I floated lots of rivers looking specifically for these birds and haven't found them. Roman said he saw them over on the Woolock River in the early 2000s, but he did a big traverse across the Brooks Range with Jason Geck. And I was in the Woolock this summer specifically looking for the birds and didn't come up with them. So there are people out there looking. There's a guy with Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Travis Booms, who's kind of leading the effort to continue looking for these birds. And there are ongoing surveys, but nobody's really finding them. Travis has put out nesting boxes on the Chandler River and some other north flowing rivers in the Brooks Range, and has gone out for the last eight summers and hasn't found any evidence of these birds nesting.
Yeah, that's an impressive effort. And birders are tenacious when it comes to finding things like this.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, the rarer the bird is, the more effort that birders will put into finding it. Birders seem to have a fetish for rare birds. And so this is a money bird for a lot of birders. And if a bird guide could reliably deliver this bird, he'd have a lot of clients. And it was that case for Bob Dittrich and Aaron Lang with Wilderness Birding Adventures for many, many years. They would fill their trips to go see these gray-headed chickadees on the Marsh Fork of the Canning. And they're still running the trips, but they're not seeing the birds.
Interesting. And they are circumarctic. Are they... Do I have that right? Are they all the way from Norway to Russia? Is that correct?
Yeah, they're all throughout Eurasia. They're from from Norway through Russia. The status of the birds in Eurasia is unclear. There are some reports of gray-headed chickadees declining through Norway, apparently due to climate change. And there's not a lot of science coming out of Russia, so we don't really know. That is expected to be their stronghold, but there's not much data in the last 10 years about the bird. So it's not clear, whether they're also in steep decline or not in Eurasia. They don't seem to be imperiled worldwide, but they seem to be the term for kind of a local disappearance is locally extinct. And so it looks like they may have completely blinked out here in North America. And these birds are probably not coming back. If they're gone from Alaska and Northwest Canada, they're probably not coming back, because chickadees, again, aren't migratory. They won't cross big bodies of water. Chickadees have never been reported from places like St. Lawrence Island or Attu or Gamble or the Pribilof. Mm-hmm. So I don't think these birds are going to make their way back across the Bering Strait. It's probable that they were a relic from the Pleistocene era, when the Bering Land Bridge extended between Russia and Alaska. Because these birds don't migrate, it's likely that this was like an eastern extension of their natural range at that time. And with the rise of sea level post Pleistocene, the birds were kind of isolated from the rest of their kindred birds there on the Eurasian side of the Bering Straits.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about the causes of the decline. First of all, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlak. We're talking about the gray-headed chickadee and with Brad Micklejohn. Brad, so let's go back to this idea of cause and why this might be happening. We mentioned climate change. What are some of the ideas that why this is going on?
Well, there's a lot of things that are speculated, Paul, but there's not much that we can say definitively. We can say that the birds were fairly common through the 1900s. They were findable until, the early 20 teens, and then maybe there were one or two places you could find them up until 2015, and then after that, just zero. It looks like that's when we kind of go off a cliff with climate chaos, increasing winter rains, much more variability in year-round temperatures. It's possible that there is an issue with interbreeding, hybridization with their relatives, the boreal chickadee. There's just a paper out that's documenting some of the potential for hybridization between boreal chickadee, their closest relative, and the gray-headed chickadee. But from everything that I'm picking up from the scientists, they don't think that's the cause of the gray-headed chickadee disappearing entirely. The speculation is, basically all chickadees around the world will hybridize with other species. So that's not unique to the gray-headed chickadee situation. And the hybridization typically doesn't decrease the fitness of the bird. It doesn't cause species to go extinct. It happens, on some rare percentage basis. But it's not a cause of significant decline. So there might have been some hybridization of gray-headed chickadees with boreals, but it's probably not the reason they blinked out. One of the speculations is surrounds an issue called phenology, which has to do with the timing of natural events like the hatching of insects and the leafing out of plants. And because of the relatively rapid warming that's occurring in the Arctic. And again, that warming is happening four times faster in the Arctic than in kind of temperate regions. You're having a mismatch of timing between, say, these birds hatching out as young and the availability of insect prey. So if the insects are hatching earlier because of the warming and the birds are locked in on a particular calendar date, which is common with birds. They'll have their young on the exact same date year to year. So if the insects hatch out too early or too late, the parents don't have anything to feed their young. Another thing that is conceivable as an impact on gray-headed chickadees is northern shrikes, which are a predaceous bird. They're not hawks, but they're very aggressive predators on small birds. And there's some speculation that northern shrikes might have killed off the last of these gray-headed chickadees because they do occupy the same habitat and they have been observed interacting. That is, the loggerhead shrikes or the northern shrikes will really do a number on the young of the gray-headed chickadees. So some of those are kind of the range of some of the competing ideas as to what's at play here.
I'm interested in this. We talk about climate change, climate chaos. I took a new article. You talk about this ecosystem as being sort of the epicenter of it, and how fast things are changing. And so I'm interested in this topic because it seems to distill a lot of what's going on. Like the rapid change in weather patterns, the rapid change of the actual ecosystem itself, and how various species of plants and animals are changing because of that, and then it affects this little bird, right? So have that the general idea.
Yeah, one of the things that might be at play here is, I know you're going to be talking to Roman Dahl pretty soon about some of his work. He's been looking into the phenomena of rusting rivers in the Brooks Range, which is basically a process of acidification where you're getting activation of certain metals due to thawing permafrost. And they're starting to see in his research over on the Kobuk that this rusting river phenomena is impacting aquatic insects, which in turn is having an impact on the salmon populations in the Kobuk. And it's entirely possible that something like that is at play for these gray-headed chickadees. That is their prey base, which is probably insects, maybe at key times of their life cycle are being affected by these rusting rivers, and the bugs just aren't there to be fed to the young. So we don't know that. A lot of this is still conjecture, but a lot of different lines of research are kind of coming together. You know, my trip this summer through the Western Arctic, I was shocked that we didn't encounter any parka squirrels, any ground squirrels over the course of a 3-week trip. And ground squirrels are kind of one of the foundational food sources for a lot of the carnivores in the Brooks Range, you know, bears and foxes and wolves and birds of prey. So there are a lot of different things going on in the Arctic. It's kind of the ground zero of climate chaos. And so it I think, you know, one of the leading theories is that these birds are basically being wiped out by some changes that, you know, like a combination of different factors.
And what about, I don't want to call it solutions, but I know in the article you talk about captive breeding and such. Talk about that.
Yeah, typically when a bird becomes rare, it kind of goes through this sort of stage of decline where, you know, they're rare and then they're extremely rare and then they're, you know, hard to find and then they're gone. And ideally, if you want to intervene, you want to catch them while there's still some birds that you can help through habitat modifications or potentially captive breeding and releases it into ideal habitat. But these birds, it's really challenging because we can't find any of them. There are 4 subspecies of gray-headed chickadee, one in North America that's genetically distinct from its cousins throughout Eurasia and Europe. So at the moment, we don't have any individuals of the subspecies of gray-headed chickadee that occurs here in North America to do any captive breeding. That is, they take the birds in, breed them in a facility that's, you know, has controlled conditions, and develop enough of a bird population that you can start releasing them back out into the wild. And that's been done successfully with birds like peregrine falcon, California condor, and a host of other birds. And there's, you know, really good science around the genetics of running those successful programs. But in this case, you know, there's talk of doing a captive breeding program to re-release these birds into the wild. But if you can't find any, you can't, you know, you don't have a founder population to work from. So it's, you know, it's kind of a tenuous situation right now. Are the birds endangered? You know, that's usually one of the categories of imperilment that is assigned to a bird that's become, you know, really reduced in population. And if the birds are gone, are they endangered? I mean, it's sort of what we're looking at with ivory-billed woodpecker. You know, ivory-billed woodpecker have been on the endangered species list for close to 50 years, and people are out looking for them. And it's kind of a hard call to make that, you know, they're completely gone. Nobody wants to make that determination that they're not there. And in the case of gray-headed chickadees, I mean, that it's a huge habitat area. They could possibly be out there somewhere. So I think the effort's going to continue to be put into finding them. And if some are found, maybe then initiate a captive breeding program to reintroduce them into locations that would be good habitat for them.
And they'd still have all the same problems.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't look like these birds are being impacted specifically by human activities like, you know, logging or mining or, you know, road building or development or some of the usual culprits that you look to, you know, that conservationists are concerned about when species become imperiled. This bird seems to be the first you know, truly a victim of climate chaos, of global warming. And, you know, there's interesting research done showing that birds and insects are extremely vulnerable to minor, relatively minor changes in temperature. And it's, you know, a bird like snow bunting is very vulnerable to overheating. And if anybody spent any time in the Brooks Range in the last 10 years, you know some of the crazy temperatures. The trip that I did this summer in the Western Brooks Range, we had temperatures in the mid to upper 80s. And I have no idea what impact that has on a bird that's adapted for temperatures in the 30s and 40s. We just don't know.
Yeah. So you published this article. What were some of the responses?
Well, it's been a pretty surprising and I've had a range of responses. Some people have said, it's a terribly depressing article. And others are encouraged to come up to Alaska and look for it. Had an email from David Sibley. And if you're a birder, you know the name David Sibley. He's sort of one of the gods of the birding world, the author of some of the best known bird guides to North American birds. And he had sent me a photo of a bird that was collected in Denali in 1925. It's currently in the Harvard Ornithology Collection. And he was asking my opinion about this particular bird. And I was a little humble because I'm not an ornithologist. I'm not even a very good birder. So people from not just Alaska, but around the country and around the world are interested in the fate of this little bird. The last time that we lost a breeding bird in North America was the ivory-billed woodpecker in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And people are still out looking for that bird. And it's, you know, it's kind of a, you know, I'm going to say canary in the coal mine, chickadee in the oil mine. You know, it tells you something about the state of the environment when you're losing species. And we tend to take it very seriously. So this is, it's kind of another alarm bell ringing. One of the positive notes to come out of this, I was contacted by researchers at the Tulik Field Station up on the North Slope, and they were out checking some of these bird boxes that have been put out, nest boxes put on the Chandler River. And they sent me a photo of what looks like it could be nesting evidence of a gray-headed chickadee in one of those nest boxes. All we have is the nest material. It fits the description of what gray-headed chickadees build in the way of nests. They took the picture in August, so, you know, after breeding season. So, you know, big question mark. It's a big state, and we can't say definitively that these birds are gone. So we're still, you know, out there looking, and that's certainly a place that we're going to go look at next summer.
Yeah. What's your, I mean, it is sort of a, could be considered sort of a sad story. Where do you find hope? Where do you find inspiration be an advocate for birds like this and advocate
what I take from it is that I try to appreciate every bird that I see. Like, I kind of wish I'd spent a little bit more time with those chickadees that Roman and I saw on the Tuk-Tuk-Tuk back in 2016. You know, every time you encounter an individual bird, it's probably the last time you're going to see that individual bird unless they come to your feeder every single day. So, like, you know, cherish the moment, like, you know, and the same could be said for your friends and family. It's like, well, you don't really ever know which is going to be the last time that you're with them. So, like, you know, every moment is precious. Every bird is precious, and learn to appreciate it. I think birders often are, you know, out checking off birds, and as soon as they've seen it, they move on. But I guess I try to be a little more appreciative of birds when they come my way.
That's an excellent idea. I will appreciate the chickadees in my backyard, even as they poop on my lawn furniture. and I'll look forward to my next trip on the marsh fork looking for them. Well, Brad, thanks for joining us today. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I've had Brad Micklejohn. We've been talking about the gray-headed chickadee. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks for your interest, Paul.
Thanks to my guests Mary Beth Holloman, Kristen Link, and Brad Micklejohn. We'll have links to their work on the Outdoor Explorer webpage. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts, keep your bird feeders full, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska.
Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.